From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. It's been almost 26 years since journalist and activist Mumia Abu-Jamal was convicted of murder. The jury gave Abu-Jamal the death penalty for the killing of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner. Abu-Jamal has always maintained his innocence and continued to fight his conviction. His case has become hotly contested, with a series of activist groups calling for his release and others who are just as adamant saying he should be executed. Late last week, a federal appeals court says he deserved a new sentencing hearing, but not a new trial. So what are the next legal moves? Soon we'll speak with Maureen Faulkner, the widow of slain police officer Daniel Faulkner. But first we've got Jeff Mackler. He's director of the Mobilization to Free Mumia Abu-Jamal in Oakland, California. Jeff, welcome.
Glad to be with you, but I can barely hear you. Let's try.
All right. We'll do our best. We know there have been some technical problems with the line. So can you explain exactly what the court ruled last week?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the question. Please try one more time.
Jeff, can you explain the court's ruling?
Okay. Well, the court ruled on Thursday against Mumia Abu-Jamal on three critical questions. We consider these in the context of what we call the Mumia exception. Our first argument was that the jury that convicted Mumia in 1982 of murdering Daniel Faulkner, a police officer, had from it excluded 10 of 14 jurors who were impaneled. And we claimed that that was a violation of a critical Supreme Court decision, Batson versus Kentucky, in 1986. The court has subsequently upheld that decision, but this U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit decision essentially, if you could believe it, reversed the Supreme Court decision. And it included the decision of the Supreme Court in Batson that said if you exclude even one black juror on the grounds of race, the result of the trial is null and void. So this three-judge panel literally violated its own precedents and the precedents of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Let me ask, do you want at this point a whole new trial, or are you satisfied with the idea of a new penalty hearing?
Are we satisfied with what?
The new penalty hearing only, or do you want an entirely new trial?
We're going to appeal full circuit, that is the 11 judges, to reverse their decision. We're confident that the decision of Judge Ambrose, who was the minority out of the three, it was a 2-1 vote, will be upheld, since that is the precedent of the full court in the Third Circuit, and it's the precedent of the Supreme Court. So they had to come up with a contorted decision. We will be appealing all three issues, and if we lose there, we'll go to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Why has this case been so controversial and so prominent?
Try that one more time, please.
Why has this case been so controversial?
Well, from our point of view, Mumia Abu-Jamal, an award-winning journalist, has been on death row as an innocent man for 26 years for a murder he didn't commit. We have submitted a wealth of information demonstrating over and over again that Mumia is an innocent man. And we simply object to the murder of an innocent man. And we think that the reason for Mumia's persecution is because he was the leading critic as a journalist of a police department whose officers, many of whose officers, were indicted, convicted, and imprisoned for corruption, falsifying evidence, intimidation of witnesses, and so on. And Mumia was punished in this case. We now have proof positive that Mumia was an innocent man and that the prosecution's case was manufactured. So we want a brand new trial, and that's what we were asking for. We lost that, and we lost on three critical constitutional questions, and we'll be appealing that and fighting for Mumia's very life. Whereas the state of Pennsylvania, they lost in their attempt to reverse a previous order. Pennsylvania seeks to execute Mumia, and they're going to be appealing that too. So to the same full court, the 11 judges, we only had a decision from three of them. So they're going to try to kill Mumia, and we're going to try to win his freedom through a new trial.
Are there any protests planned?
Yes, we've already had day after protests in about 40 cities in the United States and across the world. But we're planning a major protest in Philadelphia on April 19th. at 11 o'clock, and you can find out more about that by calling us at 510-268-9429. And here's
Jeff. Thank you so much, Jeff.
My pleasure.
Jeff Mackler is the director of the Mobilization to Free Mumia Abu-Jamal in Oakland, California. And now we turn to Maureen Faulkner. She is the widow of Daniel Faulkner, the Philadelphia police officer Mumia Abu-Jamal was convicted of murdering in 1982. Maureen, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me on.
So you just heard our conversation with Jeff Mackler. How does it make you feel when activists on his side keep pressing for the freedom of Mumia Abu-Jamal?
It emotionally upsets me for what Jeff Mackler has just said regarding the case. I was at the 1982 trial. If anyone wanted to know who murdered my husband, Danny, it was me. And I believe that Mumia Abu-Jamal did receive a fair trial in 1982, and he was found guilty, and he is guilty of murder. He's nothing but a cold-blooded murderer. And in 1995, 96, 97, 98, we've gone through the Post-Conviction Relief Act hearings, any new evidence to come forth to say that this man did not murder my husband, and it was all turned down. The conviction has been upheld that Mumia was found at the scene of the crime next to my husband. The police showed up 70 seconds after my husband was shot, and the scene was frozen in place. And to this day, Mumia Abu-Jamal nor his brother, William Cook, has come forth and said what happened that night. They were there, and they know what happened.
Now, there's a website for your husband, danielfaulkner.com, and on it you released a statement that said that this decision lets your family say Abu-Jamal is officially a murderer. What do you mean that this decision in particular sort of validates the original conviction?
Well, I think for years the defense has given false information and lies about this case and what happened the night Danny was murdered, and the Third Circuit Court of Appeals has said they've upheld the conviction. They are saying that Mumia Abu-Jamal did murder my husband. However, they did open a small loophole, which to me was very upsetting, and it's on a technicality of a jury form regarding mitigating and aggravating circumstances that the jurors did not understand that mitigating did not have to be unanimous. I was there in the courtroom. The jury they were very intelligent. If they had any questions, they would raise their hand and ask Judge Szabo the questions of any questions they had. So I really believe they understood the jury form. But once again, this case does not have closure.
Maureen, what does closure mean to you? Would you like to, at this point, see Abu-Jamal executed? Would you like to see him spend his life on death row? It still leaves behind, no matter what happens, someone and many people will be dissatisfied with the outcome. What particularly do you want to see happen?
I feel a jury back in 1982 sentenced Mumia Abu-Jamal to first-degree murder and to the death penalty. And I just wanted the sentence carried out on what this jury had made the decision on. And since then, the Faulkner family nor I have had any kind of closure. There's always something coming forth in a technicality with this case where we have to endure the pain of not knowing what is going to ever happen with the case. Now, once again, we may have to go back to a sentencing hearing, and it's been over a quarter of a century we have been dealing with this, and we want the courts to make a decision. And once they make the decision and they close this case, I'm sure the Faulkner family and I will have closure, and we will be able to live with the decision of the courts, but we want closure.
Has anyone ever reached out to you from the side of Mumia's supporters. And one thing that comes up is that because your husband was a white police officer, because Mumia Abu-Jamal was a black activist, this is sometimes framed in racial lines. But there are people of different opinions and different races on both sides of this issue. Has anyone ever reached out to you and tried to start a dialogue with you about what's been going on these past 26 years?
Yes, I've talked to several people about what has gone on over the past 26 years. And I personally think that many people make this a racial issue because Mumia Abu-Jamal was black and my husband was white. I personally feel that Mumia Abu-Jamal had a deep-seated hatred for police. And I think he was out to murder a police officer, and this is my personal opinion, when he murdered my husband. And he did murder my husband. And I do not take race into this. I really don't.
You wrote a book called Murdered by Mumia, A Life Sentence of Loss, Pain, and Injustice. What is the one thing you want to come across in that book?
In this book is the story of my life, and over the past 26 years, what I have had to endure. I co-wrote the book with Michael Smirkanish, who was wonderful enough to help me with the book. And what I want to portray is what victims and survivors go through year after year after year with the appellate court, and how they have to endure going back into the courtroom and looking into the eyes of the person who harmed either them or their loved ones. We need to change our justice system. We need to streamline our justice system. And really, the book was written about what survivors have to endure for years and years. And I must say, 100% of the proceeds we have given to a 501c3 for children whose parents have been murdered.
Well,
and
Maureen,
it goes towards the children's education.
Maureen, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you.
Maureen Faulkner is the widow of slain Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner. She's also the co-author of the new book, Murdered by Mumia, A Life Sentence of Loss, Pain, and Injustice. And she joined us from member station KCLU in Thousand Oaks, California. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. It's time now for our Africa update. And the winner is Zimbabwe's opposition claims a big lead in votes, but the final results from Saturday's key parliamentary elections are still trickling in. Many are still concerned about voter intimidation and fraud. For more, we've got Imani Countess. She's Senior Director of Public Affairs for TransAfrica Forum and has been in Zimbabwe talking with voters and observing the election process. Welcome, Imani.
Thank you for having me, Farai.
So you arrived in Zimbabwe in the days leading up to the election. What were people saying before they cast their votes, and what are they saying now?
People were excited. Some people characterized Election Day as a second Independence Day. People were looking forward to having an opportunity to cast their vote. Many of the people, in fact, most of the people that we talked to, were quite frankly fed up with the Mugabe government and were looking forward to an opportunity to help it move along.
Do they feel they got that opportunity, a fair election?
Everyone that I've talked to since Election Day is in a state of significant anxiety. Everyone that I've talked to feels that the opposition, the leading opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change, won, and won by a significant margin. And the MDC, as you know, came out fairly early on declaring victory. They were able to do that, Farai, because of a change, a pretty significant change in the election rules that were negotiated by SADC, the Southern African Development Community, which allowed for the counting at the level of the polling station, the count of votes in that polling station, and the immediate public display of those votes. So outside of every polling station, you can go and see the results. So, for example, on Sunday after the elections, I visited a polling station in the Mount Pleasant District, Ward 7 in the Mount Pleasant District of Harare, and was able to see posted on a tree the results of the election in that ward. So based upon that public data, the MDC claimed victory early on. The voting rules, however, require the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission, ZEC, to actually verify votes, and they're the only entity that has authority, the mandate, to actually declare winners and losers. The ZEC, since early Monday morning, has been releasing the results of the election in dribs and drabs. It is the most anxiety-producing process I've ever been a part of or witnessed. So, you know, in the U.S., I guess one would use the equivalent of a congressional district. Here in Zimbabwe, it's the constituency level. There are over 200 constituencies. At last count, maybe half of the constituencies had been announced, and the presidential elections had not yet been formally called.
So people are on pins and needles, and you remain in Zimbabwe, but when Election Day came around, you went out with a friend to vote.
Absolutely. I went out. My friend and I, we were at the polls at 7 a.m. It was a beautiful day. There was a very long queue. It was orderly, peaceful. People were excited, laughing and joking. The poll opened a little late. It was supposed to open exactly at 7. It probably opened around 7:30. She was able to cast her vote by about 9:20, so we were in that line for a couple of hours. And people were, in general, exuberant about the opportunity and the possibility of change. There were a number of younger voters, first-time voters in the line, and there were a number of people like my friend who grew up supporting ZANU-PF as the party of liberation, the party that brought independence to the country. But over the last 5 years, because of a steep decline in the economy, as well as a growing awareness of corruption, quite frankly, within the government, just become disillusioned. And so when she cast her vote, she said up until the time she went into the booth, she wasn't quite sure which of the opposition candidates she was going to vote for. She told me in the end she voted for MDC with Morgan Tsvangirai.
Last time I was in Zimbabwe was a little over a year ago. What is it like on the very basic level at this point as you look around the country in terms of being able to access transportation, food, necessities?
I was here a little over a year ago as well, and I didn't think it could get much worse, but it certainly has. The shops are still short of basic commodities, and even if the shops have the commodities, people, quite frankly, cannot afford them. They can't afford the products in the stores. Many of the products that are not available in stores are available on the black market, where the prices, of course, are even higher. It is astonishing to me how people get on a day-to-day basis. Let me just give you an example. I spoke with one woman today whose monthly salary is 200 million Zimbabwe dollars. Farai, 1 kg of beef cost 150 million dollars. Her rent is 150 million Zim dollars a month. To ride a kombi, you know, the local transportation vehicles, can cost up to $110 million a day. So if you're only making $200 million a month, you cannot survive. The woman I mentioned earlier who makes $200 million a month, she will take her money and go and buy bread, and she'll sell bread on the streets as a part of the black market. She has been able to pull some money together to raise chickens, and then she will sell the chickens when they come to maturity. People are doing all kinds of things. Just spending one day with my friend, I saw her visit some of her friends, and they bartered. They exchanged fruit for greens, greens for fish, people are just doing whatever they can. They're using their extended family networks, and that's what people are doing on a daily basis. And an incredible number of people have left the country. So those people that have access to outside remittances are able to benefit from those remittances. But you can go on the internet and buy petrol for people in Zimbabwe. You can buy groceries for people in Zimbabwe that are then trucked from South Africa to any part of Zimbabwe. So that's one way that people are able to hold themselves and their children together.
Well, Imani, we certainly are glad that you were able to give us a report from the ground, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
Imani Countess is Senior Director of Public Affairs for the Trans-Africa Forum. She's been observing the elections in Zimbabwe and spoke with us from the capital, Harare. Now we've got more on the Zimbabwean elections and news from Somalia with Amira Woods. She's the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Amira, great to have you on again.
It's a joy to be with you.
So you just heard Imani Countess talk about the posting of election results in each ward, but who's really responsible for counting the votes?
Well, technically it is that Zimbabwe Election Commission, and they are coming together in one central place. This was hotly debated. You know, they are collecting data from all around the country and tallying it in one central place, in spite of the fact that each individual polling place, and there were, you know, again, all over the country, these polling places were able to post the results as of Saturday. But yet somehow the Electoral Commission wants to have this central collection and tallying to be able to put out what they say the official results of this election. They are the only ones vested with that capacity, with that responsibility.
I've talked to people in Zimbabwe and, just everyday folks, and they're all on pins and needles awaiting the results. Some people say, uh-oh, the vote's going to be hijacked. Other people are like, perhaps if Mugabe loses, he's going to try to get out of the country and build a feather nest somewhere else. What's going on? When can we actually expect the results? And is there a chance they'll be tampered with?
Well, we just don't know. I mean, honestly, as of this moment, I think there are 2/3 of the vote on the parliamentary results that have been tallied and officially announced. And it is very close from that official announcement between MDC, the Movement for Democratic Change, and ZANU-PF, the ruling party's candidates in the parliament. MDC is slightly ahead in those official results, but they are really neck and neck, according to these most recent reports, with 2/3 of the counting in. But on the presidential election side, we really don't have any official announcement 3 days after the election, you know, and it is appalling, really, that it is taking so long for the results on the presidential election to be announced. Now, there have been, again, it's unconfirmed reports, but the Movement for Democratic Change says that they feel they have actually won the majority, and there are reports on BBC and elsewhere that they may have up 48% of the vote. Some say it's slightly higher. They may not have the 51% needed to avoid a runoff, but that is all unclear. The longer this process goes without an official announcement coming from the ZEC, the Zimbabwean Electoral Commission, it is really appalling. And you have more and more pronouncements. You know, the Pan-African Parliament, which was there as an observer mission, one of the few international observer missions in Zimbabwe for the elections, their official observer said, look, what is happening? The results were pretty much known days ago, and yet delay after delay on these announcements, it's creating such uncertainty. And, you know, I'm here in Maryland, Farai, and we had one district in Maryland on election night. Because there was a snowstorm, the results weren't announced until the next day, and we were all on pins and needles for just a couple hours.
Right.
That was the Donna Edwards candidate here in Maryland. But can you imagine waiting 3-4 days, as it seems like we're heading towards now, without knowing the results of an election? That is so critical, particularly in an environment where there is such a demand for change, in an environment where people left their various places of exile from South Africa, from Mozambique, from all around the region, to take that courageous and costly stand to go home and vote.
Well, Amira, let me jump in, because the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, is actually worried that there hasn't been enough election monitoring. And here's what she said.
We've made very clear our concerns about how this election might be conducted given the very bad record of Mugabe concerning his people, the opposition, the region, and we've tried to make a case, and as has the entire world, that there needed to be free and fair elections in Zimbabwe as much as it was possible.
Now, the U.S. has made has not been shy about calling Mugabe in Zimbabwe kind of rogue and outside of the interest of the U.S. What do you think the U.S. has at stake in this election?
Well, clearly, when it comes to Africa, the U.S. is interested in Africa's resources. That is clear, regardless of what the country. And we have to remember, Zimbabwe does have mining interests that are very much relevant and very much at play. But I think there is a more subtle issue here where, you know, Mugabe has actually been able to get on his bully pulpit and rise up, you know, speaking out against the U.S. and the former colonizers, the U.K. For him, it is these external hands that have created the economic crisis that is currently in Zimbabwe, and you know, discussions in the U.S. State Department using the term regime change after that term was actually placed on Iraq. We saw what happened in the case of Iraq. Regime change has led to disaster. Now, when people hear regime change coming out of the State Department, there's a lot of worry about manipulation of processes, and so there is concern that the U.S. may not be playing fair, that there may be backhanded deals in which certain organizations are supported by the U.S. And these actually contribute to a climate of anxiety where the U.S. and the U.K., even if they may be saying absolutely the right thing in this context, are not seen as really honest brokers.
Let's take a quick tour of what's going on in Somalia. You've got insurgents continuing to battle the Somali government, and the United Nations Security Council is considering if it should send more than 25,000 peacekeepers to Somalia to replace the stretched African Union force. Now, briefly, what are the negotiations going on around that?
Well, let's remember, Farai, Somalia is a country that was without a government for 15 years. Finally, in June 2006, a government came to power. It was called the Union of Islamic Courts. And from June 2006 to December 2006, they were able to maintain governance in Somalia, and they were able to maintain peace and stability. People could send their children to school, women could walk the streets, and yet the U.S., again, the heavy hand of the U.S., deciding that, well, the Union of Islamic Courts had Islamic in their name, and they must be extremists. And so the U.S. started aerial bombardment from December 06 until really about a month ago. We were hearing reports of U.S. bombardments in Somalia, creating instability in the country that has really continued till this day. So you have almost daily reports of skirmishes, of fights, and the report this week was of a battle, really, between the former forces of this Union of Islamic States and these Ethiopian troops that are really seen as a proxy for the U.S. there in Somalia. So what is happening is you have innocent civilians being caught in the middle. And there is tremendous discussion and debate going on within the U.N. At the Security Council level, also within the African Union, as to how can peace and also and be returned to Somalia again. So there are a number of efforts underway to put forward, for example, a resolution that neighboring states, particularly Ethiopia, should not have troops permanently stationed, that the ending the occupation of Ethiopia, Ethiopian troops in Somalia, is a core part of bringing the voice of the Somali people, peace and stability to Somalia again. So there are negotiations underway as to how can we end, how can the international community play a role to bring an end to the violence that has so crippled Somalia in the last year and a half, and how do you withdraw not only the Ethiopian forces, but also the U.S. attacks that have had such detrimental impacts on civilians.
Well, Amira, we're going to have to leave it there for today. Thanks again.
A pleasure. Thank you, Farai.
Amira Woods is co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, and she joined us from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Conventional sports history has it that boxer Jack Johnson was the first great African-American athlete. But that distinction might go to Marshall Walter Taylor, better known as Major Taylor. At the dawn of the 20th century, Taylor was an international champion of the popular sport of cycling. Todd Balfe is a cycling enthusiast. He's made it his mission to bring Major Taylor's story into the 21st century. He's also written the book Major, A Black Athlete, A White Era, and the Fight to Be the World's Fastest Human Being. Balfe spoke about Major Taylor with NPR's Tony Cox.
Taylor and Johnson are an interesting comparison because I think on face value, a lot of people have heard of Jack Johnson, who really caused waves wherever he went and whatever he did, whereas Taylor preceded him. And in fact, Johnson refers to Taylor, you know, and says that because of Taylor's notoriety as a bike racer, he actually, before he took up boxing, he took up bike riding and only took up boxing after he crashed his bicycle and realized that it really wasn't the sport for him. So, you know, juxtaposing Taylor and Johnson, Taylor was a much different character. You know, on face value, he was modest, he was religious, he seemed to be somewhat more passive than a Johnson. And yet, I think that what's been mistaken in this sort of view and comparing the two is that they were both deeply principled and deeply devoted to their principles.
Did Taylor get to the very pinnacle of his sport? And if so, give us some sense of just how much of a factor in terms of bicycle riding worldwide he was
right
at the height of his career.
It's really astounding what Taylor was able to accomplish in a very short amount of time. If you think that really he started professional racing at Madison Square Garden in 1896 in a 6-day races, an event that he was not well suited for as a sprinter, but it was a way to get his name out there. By 1899, he was world champion. By 1901, he was traveling through all the European capitals and was being paraded around Paris as the American champion, a superstar. And I think that's where the division lies between Taylor and some of his black contemporary athletes of that time period. Taylor broke through onto the international scene. And he was, and in fact, today, if you were to look into the kind of research and attention that Taylor's legacy has held, you know, you're seeing more material coming out of countries like Australia or France, Germany, places where he raced and was renowned as the superstar that he was.
When he was in the United States and at the pinnacle as a racer, was or how was race an issue for him in dealing with the American public?
Race was an ever-present issue for Taylor. You know, it manifested itself in many different ways. He was not recognized as a member of the League of American Wheelmen, for example. He was prohibited, banned from racing in Indianapolis and in Indiana when he was a young man, which forced him to relocate to Worcester, Massachusetts. You know, promoters were very, very reluctant, especially in the South, to have him in a race field where he would, quote-unquote, humiliate the field by beating all the white rivals put in front of him. You know, the obstacles put before him because of the color of his skin were just innumerable. So you saw at that time period in the early 1900s, this sort of, you know, fleeing or forced fleeing of athletes going to other countries. It happened in horse racing. It happened in boxing, as we all know, even with Jack Johnson. And it happened with Taylor. And it is the reason why Taylor's name is not known in a league with Jack Johnson or Jackie Robinson or others, because his fame really came abroad. It did not come the way it could have happened or should have happened in America.
What happened after his career ended?
Taylor's career really peaked in 1904 when he beat his longtime rival Floyd McFarlane and won what was really considered the world championship in Australia, which is ironic, since that's also where Jack Johnson would be victorious a few years later. But after his racing career completed, you know, here was a man who had gained wealth. He had quite a little nest egg to sit on. He'd gained notoriety around the world. And yet he had to then come back into American life as something other than an athlete. And it all went wrong from him right from the start. The money that he had saved, he invested in businesses that went belly up. It wasn't a matter of him blowing money on wine, women, and song. It was just, he even tried to educate himself and go to college, and he was not accepted at Worcester Polytech Institute, which is fairly hard to believe, given his fame at the time. And so it was one frustration after another, and eventually his life really crumbled around him. He separated from his wife, he separated from his child, and he wandered off to Chicago, where he tried to sell his autobiography, and eventually died penniless in 1932.
We've already talked about how in American culture, particularly in African American history, there is not a great mention of Major Taylor. And yet, at the same time, here a century later, his name is beginning to resurface with organizations like the IMO Major Taylor Team, which I guess operates somewhere in the Midwest. Bicyclists, particularly African-American bicyclists, are now competing in his memory in some cases, are they not?
They are. People are attaching to Major Taylor in a surprisingly powerful way. I think that what's going on there is people are looking for these examples, looking for heroes, looking for people who did something extraordinary. And Taylor certainly qualifies.
Todd, thank you so much. Job well done. We appreciate you coming on.
Thank you for having me.
That was NPR's Tony Cox talking with Todd Balfe. Balfe is the author of Major, A Black Athlete, A White Era, and The Fight to Be the World's Fastest Human Being. Martin Luther King Jr. was gunned down 40 years ago this week. News of the shooting spread like wildfire. Rioting in black neighborhoods from Seattle, Washington to Washington, D.C. painted the picture of a nation going up in flames. In Boston's Black Roxbury neighborhood, the rioting was particularly hot. And then the Godfather of Soul stepped in with a little funk to cool things down. On April 5th, 1968, the day after King was killed, James Brown took the stage at the Boston Garden. The televised concert featured Brown's call for peace. That night, Mr. Dynamite might have kept Beantown from burning down. David Leaf's new film, The Night James Brown Saved Boston, premieres this Saturday on VH1. Hi, David.
Thank you for having me.
So first, let's get a little context about James Brown. By 68, how big was the Godfather of Soul, and how major was this concert, which had been scheduled well before King's death?
In 1960, James Brown was 3 years into what would have in those days been called his crossover career. He finally made it big on the pop charts after a half dozen years of being a major R&B attraction in the mid-1960s with songs like Papa's Got a Brand New Bag and I Feel Good. So he was not just appealing to black audiences primarily, but he had a pretty significant mixed audience as well. In the mid-60s, he played a place called the Boston Arena, which seated around 6,000 or 7,000. So playing the Boston Garden on April 5th, 1968 was a step up for him because that seated almost 15,000 people. So it was indicative of how much his popularity had grown through the years. And so this was just a regular concert that had been scheduled. He was known as the hardest working man in show business, did more than 200 dates a year. And this was just the latest stop.
James Brown went into the streets of Harlem as the tension on America's streets was building. And here's Brown explaining his decision to walk right into the fray.
I don't want to be a cat sitting from up high looking down and saying, wonder what they're doing. I was down there, find out what's happening. And I know how everybody feels because I might live in society, but my heart's in the ghetto because that's where I'm born, you see.
How did Brown react to the news of King's death?
When news of Dr. King's assassination reached James Brown, he was in a recording studio in New York City, and he immediately went on the air, television and radio, calling for peace. He was obviously very upset. How could you not be? And as news of the rage in the communities of inner-city America reached Brown, he decided that he needed to go look for himself. So he went up to Harlem, uptown in New York City, to see what was going on. And he was not happy with what he saw. He was heartbroken to see black Americans destroying their own neighborhoods. And so when he got to Boston the next day, he knew that he needed to do what he could to help keep the peace in Boston.
Boston is a city which has had some ignominious moments in racial history, some real hardcore tensions. And in 1968, the mayor of Boston was Kevin White. You interviewed him for the film, and his initial plan was to cancel this concert. How did he change his mind, and how did he tell you what he did to sort of have a change of heart on this?
Well, Kevin White had been elected in November of 1967 as a progressive candidate. The candidate he was running against was against desegregation. She was against integration. So in this racially divided city, on the morning of April 5th, the chief of police said to Mayor White, "I don't think I can keep the city safe if you allow 15,000 people to come to this concert. I'm not sure I can guarantee security." So they were going to cancel the concert. There had been rioting in Roxbury the night previous, but it was contained. That's where they wanted to keep it localized, and they were concerned that 15,000 young black people coming to downtown Boston would be, you know, a light would go off and there would be a riot. But when news that the concert was about to be canceled reached black activists in the Roxbury community, they got in touch with Tom Atkins, who was a city councilman, who said to the mayor, "If you cancel this concert in the wake of Dr. King's assassination and 15,000 kids show up and the gates to the Boston Garden are locked, you will have a riot."
According to your film, the plan to show it on TV brought its own set of problems, especially for James Brown. What was wrong with that deal in James's eyes, and how did he, Atkins, and the mayor work it all out?
When James Brown arrived in Boston that afternoon of April 5th, he was more than a little bit surprised to find out that not only were people lined up at the Boston Garden to get refunds for tickets, but that an announcement had spread like wildfire throughout the city that the concert was going to be on television. Now, James Brown is an entrepreneur. He's a capitalist. And he was a promoter of his own shows. The way he made money was to put on concerts, take the risk. You know, he had a band of 20 people, and an entourage, so and a Learjet even. So he had enormous expenses on a daily basis that he needed to be reimbursed for if this concert were going to be on television. But the primary problem was James Brown was expecting to take in somewhere between $50,000 and $100,000 at the box office that night. And suddenly, with the concert on television, with refunds being offered and people lined up to bring their tickets back, he was looking at there being very few people at the Garden. He said to the city, "How are you going to make me whole here?"
And what did they tell him?
The truth of what happened behind the scenes the night of that concert in terms of how much money James was going to get, how much he actually got, is a really complicated tale. And it's Rashomon. Nobody really tells the same story. But the person who speaks for James Brown, his longtime personal manager who was there that night, says, "We were promised a certain amount of money, and we only got $10,000. The next person who speaks in the movie is the mayor, who says, "Well, James was worth the $60,000. Somewhere between that $10,000 and that $60,000 left the mayor's office, but only $10,000 seems to have gotten to James Brown.
Well, that's the concert biz. And let's get down to concert night. Here is a clip of Brown soon after he starts the show.
"I want you to know. Ain't no sin, because I'm acting with my friends. My friends. My friends. To do it all over again. But that's life.
So when you interviewed band members and concert goers, how'd they describe the energy in the Garden that night, and how did they describe what the show meant to them?
The band, which was primarily black, interestingly enough, James Brown had a white bass player, at that time. So it was an integrated band, which was extraordinarily unusual in that era. Everybody was tense backstage before the show. Everybody was tense on stage. In those days, there was no real security. There was no wanding. They didn't check your bag to see if you had a gun in it. So anybody could have come into the Boston Garden, and you know, it was a scary situation for everybody. People were expecting a disaster at any moment.
So since the title of the film is The Night James Brown Saved Boston, I assume you believe that. I assume you believe that he did.
Well, it's honestly, it's not my belief. The story is told from the point of view of the people who were there, or the most respected historians in the country, like Dr. Cornel West. So between the band members, the mayor's office, the mayor, the city councilor, the mayor's press secretary, the people from WGBH who produced the broadcast, the people who went to the concert, the evidence, as we see in the newspaper clippings from that era, what happened was James Brown took the stage. Everybody was off the streets. There was no reports of any significant rioting or activity, unlawful activity that evening. And what happened with the television broadcast was that after the concert ended, they immediately played it again, and then they played it again, and people kept watching it. You have to remember, music on television was a different animal in those days. You were lucky to see your favorite act once a year on the Ed Sullivan Show. So for an artist of James Brown's stature and magnitude, you didn't get to see James Brown perform for 2 hours on television. So for the people in the city of Boston, music fans, James Brown fans, this was a gift. And it kept people really distracted from the pain and anguish they were feeling.
David, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
David Leaf's new film, The Night James Brown Saved Boston, premieres this Saturday on VH1.